Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in the Law, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jeffrey Bristol, and I am a host on the channel. Today, we are speaking with Professor R.H. Helmholtz, the Ruth Wyatt Rosenson Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. We are here to discuss his book, Natural Law in Court. Natural Law in Court serves as a guide to the uses of natural law in the past. It shows how lawyers, judges, and jurists use natural law as a kind of reason to argue about various points of law, be they procedural or substantive. Far from being a simple polemic, this book delves into the legal record of multiple countries to compare, contrast, and shed light on the role natural law played in actual legal disputes. Due to the renewed interest in natural law today, this book serves as an important counterpoint to legal thinkers who too often rely on purely philosophical or theoretical notions of natural law in their arguments, and shows how natural law was and potentially can be deployed to make effective legal arguments in actual legal proceedings. In our discussion today, we will talk about what natural law is, how courts use it, why it has fallen out of favor, as well as some new, maybe even unexpected developments in natural law thinking. So without further ado, I'd like to thank you, Professor Helmholtz, for joining us today on the New Books Network sharing us some of the lessons you've learned in your very interesting book.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So first, I'd like to start off with just a very general question. What is natural law?
Well, That's not too simple. That's not too easy a question to answer, because it seems to have become something now that it was not then in the centuries when it was accepted by virtually all lawyers. I would say the best way to do it, to understand the latter point, is to look at the Roman law and the developed canon law on the subject, which treated natural law as a feature of, as a law of human behavior and human life that was established from the beginning, from the creation of man and woman, was the foundation, really, of the of legal, or one foundations for legal development. Of course, there were others. There was the jus gentium, that is the law of nations, and there was, of course, positive law, and for Christians anyway, for biblical law. But the starting point for evaluating for development of a legal system was what had always existed in human society.
So what was the relationship of natural law to some of these other things historically? You've mentioned a couple of other points, positive law, canon law, and obviously this changes over time, but was natural law seen as a supplement to those, as overriding them, or what?
Well, it was not overriding them. That would be too strong a phrase. They were to be based upon natural law and to add to it. A pretty good example of that is that the jus gentium, that is the law of nations, was the foundation of general law. It was different than natural law because it was the law that it was arrived at on the organization of society. Natural law didn't have much to do with government, for specific aspects of government or rulership. It had to do with what had always been there and was in still there in human nature. And I think the probably the best way to answer is just to give you an example of what natural law was, and just take the one from my book, which was the duty of parents to care for their children. That had always been true. It was true. It's true of birds and other animals. And that shows that the parents do have a duty to care for their children, and also that the children owe some obedience to the parents. And that can be added to by the law, which is adopted when we organize our society. But still, it remained the base of the law, the starting point. And it was used to fill in uncertainties and to keep us from going off track.
And so natural law, where did it come from? Did people find it written somewhere? Did people, you know, reason about it? I mean, what are kind of some of the arguments that developed natural law and gave it its you know, maybe legitimacy and basis in legal thinking?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. There was, of course, an enormous literature on the subject of natural law.
I mean, I suppose, we find positive law, for example, in statutes, Roman law, of course, you know, in later recensions we find from the Codex and, you know, Justinian's compilations of various things. You know, we know positive laws, you know, we look in a statute book, common law, we can find precedent, we can read the court cases from the past. So is natural law, did people read philosophers for it? Did people, was it just a product of people reasoning about things that they saw in the world around them? Can you give us a sense of how maybe natural law, you know, developed or how people thought about it?
Well, I think the only way I can answer that was with an example. Should you keep your promises? If you promise to do something, should you perform that promise? And I think the answer to that is, if you think about it, yes, you should, if other people rely on it. Otherwise, our society would kind of fall apart. But it's not an unlimited principle. It's a starting point, and there can be a lot of excuses, a lot of reasons for not following your promise. But the use of natural law in something like that would be, unless there's one of those legitimate excuses, you ought to do what you promised to do because people rely on it, and you want to be able to rely on them. That's the nature of human society, really. So that gives you a starting point. It doesn't answer all the questions that the law will throw off in the course of organizing a commercial society, but it's good to have in your back pocket as a way of interpreting statutes and as a way of dealing with problems for which there's no clear legal answer. And I think one of the things that I discovered in, or at least was reminded of in doing the research for the book, is how often it happens that there is no clear legal answer in the statute books. And that's where natural law, which says that you ought to keep your promises, could come into play. I'm not sure if that responds fully to your question.
No, I think that's excellent. I think that gives us a good idea of how natural law works. So would you say natural law fills in the gaps where law may not cover? And another thing I was kind of interested in, well, let me just leave that question standing. Would you say that natural law then, one of its main functions is to fill the gaps where we may not see positive law having effect?
Yeah, that's right. And the only thing I want to add to that is how often it happens that there are gaps or uncertainties in understanding what a statute says and does. A lot of people think that the practice of law is a matter of just giving an answer on the basis of what you find in the statute books. But that ain't so. There are always going to be uncertain areas. And that's one of the functions that natural law served in the times when it was accepted by all lawyers. That is to help you deal with uncertainties or omissions in the law. I think we just can't expect the law, the practice of law, to have had an answer to every question. It didn't, and it doesn't. And that's what natural law wants. That's the function it once served.
Well, in your book, you also raise some very interesting situations where natural law also can serve as a supplement to interpreting positive law. It almost seemed like sometimes natural law might function almost like what we would call today as a canon of construction. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, that's absolutely right. That's exactly what it did. It helped you construe a statute because the assumption was, and I think this is one of the things which surprised me a little bit, but the assumption was that the legislators had in the back of their minds at the time they enacted a statute a consideration of what natural law on the subject was, and therefore it made sense to interpret the statute with that in mind. If you assume, in other words, that the makers of a statute thought that the natural law was that people should keep their promises unless there was a good reason not to, then that would help you understand a commercial statute, which set up a system for enforcing contracts or even informal statements or promises.
And so one of the things I found interesting in your book, you mentioned a couple of times where natural law and positive law might have conflicted with one another and the results that happened then. So two of the examples I'm thinking of, the first is slavery. You discussed that several times where most European thinkers at least agreed that slavery was against natural law, yet often operated in legal contexts where they had to recognize the property rights of slavery. And the other one I think was interesting that stood out, hit on something that you mentioned earlier about family laws and how often in European contexts there would be laws against bastardy, where somebody that was a bastard whose parents were not married would be disinherited, and that natural law seemed to cut against that. But the outcome was not necessarily determined by natural law. So could you talk a little bit about what happened in the past when you had these kinds of conflicts between, you know, what seemed like a very strong natural law argument and positive statutes or customary legal practice?
Sure. I think that's the point about natural law that comes through loud and clear in looking at its use in the past, is that it wasn't a constitutional law in the sense that we now understand the American Constitution. That is to say that any law contradicts or goes against one of the provisions of the U.S. Constitution should be struck down by a court. Natural law didn't work that way. It was a tool for interpretation, for dealing with problems that were uncertain. If it conflicted with positive law, positive law would prevail. And so there's no better example of it than of that feature of natural law than slavery. It was a fact of life, and it was part of the positive law, even though it was clear enough that all men were supposed to have been born free, and that clearly was not true in the society of ancient Rome or in the Middle Ages. That sad fact contradicted natural law, but it was the fact. That was the situation. So it's important to remember that in terms of if thinking about the function that natural law served, it wasn't a trump card.
But one of the things I also thought was interesting was that it also could serve as a source of justice. So you also discuss, and it's one of the things I found the most interesting in the book, is thinking about natural law from a procedural standpoint. And you mentioned a couple of times where natural law provided a kind of criminal procedural bulwark when in terms of discussing the rights that individuals might have, maybe even before we thought of the term rights in that sense. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, that's another good example. The it was clear under natural law that no one should be punished unless they had had the chance to rebut the charge that brought against them. Why was that so? Well, it's not fair to deprive someone of his liberty or his life without having a chance to present your own defense of yourself. And that was part of natural law, and that functioned as an argument for making sure that people did have a chance to defend themselves when they come into court and to speak up for themselves. But it's a nice example, too, of the uses to which natural law could be put, because it will occur to you that most people who are accused of crimes are not able to defend themselves terribly well against the force that they meet in a court or in the prosecution by the government. And so what natural law does in that circumstance is make you think about what what's necessary to put into place a fair system for determining guilt or innocence. And that obviously comes into play in the move to allow defendants in criminal cases to be represented by counsel. For many centuries, they were not given that right. They had to defend themselves. They were guaranteed by natural law the right to defend themselves. But if you think about it, is that actually carrying through the promise that natural law gives you of being able to make a defense? And in that circumstance, natural law serves as a kind of a spur to thinking about what an adequate defense actually is. And it's come to mean that you do have a right to a lawyer to help you in the circumstance where you're accused of a crime and the state is coming after you. But that never meant that you always had a right to have a lawyer speak for you. It didn't mean that in the Middle Ages, and it doesn't mean that in many places today. What's guaranteed by natural law is your right to defend yourself. But the natural law does help you with an argument that makes you try to evaluate what is meant by effective help. I'm not sure that's answering your question, but that's the example.
No, that's a wonderful answer. I think it makes it very clear. So, you know, we've established natural law is a very useful thing, and it's been with us for a long time. You mentioned it's stretching back to the Romans and the Greeks, and your book does an ample job demonstrating the long heritage through the medieval period and the early modern to the modern period. But in the contemporary world, we hear a lot less about natural law. So I was wondering, where did natural law go? Is it still around, or have we abandoned it? And if it's not as obvious now as it used to be, what might be the reason for that?
Well, I'm not sure. That's a question that I had myself. And I'm happy to be able to say that there are now two books. One has just appeared, and the other is about to appear, which try to answer that question in the American context. One is by Andrew Forsyth. I have it in my hand, Common Law and Natural Law in America, and the other is by Stuart Banner. It hasn't been published yet, but it's the same subject, and both of them try to figure out what it was that caused natural law to lose its grip on the work and the minds of most lawyers. So would it be appropriate for me to just describe them, what they say, a little bit?
Yes, please do. I'm fascinated to hear it, and I think our listeners would be as well.
They too take two different approaches. Forsyth says he looks at sort of the people involved, and finds that some American lawyers or influential figures changed their mind about natural law, and they had an enormous effect on the acceptance of natural law by lawyers. And the key figures that Forsyth uses are Oliver Wendell Holmes, who thought natural law was nonsense, and the dean of Harvard Law School, Christopher Columbus Langdell, who also abandoned the use of natural law, and says that their influence was such that the subject of natural law lost its hold on the minds of most American lawyers. I think there are some problems with that explanation, but that's what he says, and he makes an interesting case for it. The other Banner's book, which hadn't yet appeared, but I had a look at it, doesn't take the personal approach that Forsyth's book takes. He says that there are three real basic reasons for his abandonment, all three of which are internal to the legal profession. And they were, first, that there was an enormous increase in the 19th century in the number of published cases. There were no official reporters in the 18th century and before, but in the 19th century, there was this absolute explosion in the number of reported cases, and that was enough for lawyers who had practical arguments to make to find their support in them. Second, that there's an abandonment at the time of the common law rule that Christianity was part of natural law. That Christianity was part of the common law, that is, of the law of the land in England and in the United States. And lawyers in the United States, having ceased to accept that as a positive part of the law, discarded natural law at the same time. And the third reason was the uncertainty of natural law. Banner says that the lawyers argued about what natural law did, and it seems that they got tired of arguing with each other about natural law just because it didn't lead to definite answers. Now, that had never been true of natural law in terms of giving you a clear answer on every legal question, but it had been part of natural law in furnishing the argument for lawyers. And Stuart Banner says, well, they just got tired of doing that because they wanted definite answers and didn't always get them from a natural law. And it's kind of an argument of fatigue from arguing. You get tired of something arguing, and therefore you let it go because it's not leading you anywhere. So that's what we have so far on that point. My book didn't touch on that subject at all. And it's, of course, an interesting and important subject to understand. I had thought it was some exterior shock, like the Civil War or the some other natural event. But I think probably that was wrong. At least it's not what Banner and Forsyth looked to explain the disappearance of natural law.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. I think particular Banner's final point, it sounds like, actually could link with Forsyth's in the sense that, you know, the uncertainty of natural law with the rise of empiricism, you know, pragmatism, which, of course, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. was a major proponent of, you know, kind of the idea that emerged with legal realism that, you know, the law is a set of definitive declarations kind of makes the ambiguity inherent in natural law seem a little suspect, I think.
I think that's what they say, yeah, and I think that's right. But the answer to it is that it always been true. There was always argument about what natural law did, and probably the most famous historical example of that is the contest over mare clausum in the 17th century by Grotius. He was answered by other, that is, whether there was a freedom of the seas. And the seas should be open to all who ventured forth on the seas without hindrance from the government. But Grotius was answered by the Mare Clausum folks, who said that that was not a permissible, it was not a clear reading of natural law, and there were many arguments for the closed sea, which is all controlled by the government. So there was nothing new about that. It's just that the lawyers in the 19th century got tired of that uncertainty. That's what you have to explain, really.
I think it's also interesting, you know, this is maybe one of my personal critiques of legal realism, but also at a certain level, if, you know, the law is whatever the judge says it is, then why can't natural law be a part of the law if the judge wants to use natural law reasoning to determine things? You know, I think that's, but you know, another thing that I think is interesting, and this is something I've often thought about in terms of the decline of natural law, which links, I think, your book with some of, it sounds like, Banner's arguments is, you know, the rise of court cases and, you know, particularly in the late 19th century, the development of the, you know, court case method in law textbooks, which is, you know, how lawyers are educated today. And, you know, I think one of the things I liked about your book, and this kind of brings us back to your work, is the connection, you deep connection you draw between legal pedagogy and legal theory, specifically natural law theory. And your book very strongly implies, really directly states, I think sometimes, that the education that lawyers received in natural law was a major component in shaping their thinking about natural law and maybe the law in general. So I was wondering, could you tell us, why did you choose to structure your book in this way, where you kind of have, you know, chapters based on, you know, or at least sections of chapters based on legal pedagogy, and then sections based on the actual legal research that you conducted? I think it's a very, very interesting, very strong way of doing it. But, you know, I guess if you could make a little explicit the connections you see between the pedagogy and the practice, I think that would be very interesting.
Well, I did it for a practical reason, and that was to in order to establish that the that lawyers, when they were being educated, had learned something about the natural law. That's, of course, no longer true, but I think my attempt was to show that it's not a surprise that lawyers knew something about natural law and used it. If you look back at what they learned when they were at the law school or at the university, if you start your legal training with a recognition of natural law's existence and refer to it from time to time as you're going through the statutes or the different areas that the law covers, it won't be a surprise to find that you introduce it in your arguments yourself when you get into law practice. So I thought it was important to start with a showing that the natural law was something that you did learn about in law school. And that was true even in the early days of American legal education, where most of what university training there was in law was done in colleges rather than in a law school. And what you find there is that there were the lectures on law that were given in the colonial and the early federal period did have some component of natural law in them. And I'm not sure it's true what Maitland said long ago, that taught law is tough law. I've never quite understood what that meant exactly, but if it contains any truth, to show that the lawyers had learned something about natural law and learned to use it a little bit in their university training, explains, I think, in some measure, the natural tendency they had to use it in legal practice. Whether or not that works very well in the book, I'm not so sure. But that was my thought. That was my thinking.
Well, I thought it was fascinating, particularly, like I said, because of the connection it drew between the two. And I think that I can see from a structure, I think it works well in giving you a concrete entrance into the world of natural law. And you know, I think, again, maybe this is also just, I often think about, you know, the ways law is taught, or the way particularly law is taught and its consequence for practice. And you know, I can't help but think this is something, I am not a legal historian myself, but, you know, as I understand, before the case method of teaching law, you know, back when law was taught in colleges, learned in colleges, often, you know, you hear about lawyers who were, you know, learned all of everything they knew from Blackstone and, you know, reading legal maxims, which still somewhat survive. You know, you have little Latin phrases like in pari delecto, melioris conditio, possidentis, stuff like that, that sometimes make their appearance in judicial rulings, but no longer are we really a legal field that relies on maxims to build legal arguments and judicial decisions. We rely much more heavily on precedent. And it seems to me interesting that that produces a kind of thinking that is less amenable to the natural law, perhaps, because, you know, you don't have precedents from natural law. It's not about analogical reasoning as much as it is about thinking in terms of maxims and in terms of principle.
That's one of the attractive features, I think, of Banner's book, is that he uses the proliferation of case law to show that we don't really need, that the lawyers decided they didn't really need natural law anymore. There were fewer gaps to fill than there were earlier. And the fact that there were so many cases out there and that they were better, they better served the practical functions that lawyers had to confront helps explain why the disappearance of natural law from the courtrooms.
So, given that change, what do you think would be the natural? You know, if you move your book into the present/future, the present is the future for the purposes of your book. What should the role of natural law be in our system? Does it have a role any longer? Have we outgrown it? Does it have anything to tell us?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a propagandist for natural law. There are a fair number of them out there, but I don't. I'm a legal historian, not a polemicist. And so I may have to dodge that question and say that I hope the book provides a reason not to be frightened by natural law, but it also might be a warning to the people who are very much in favor of the return of natural law to our society, to remember that it didn't do everything that they hoped natural law, the recognition of natural law, will do. It didn't, and I think the natural lawyers of earlier centuries would have said it shouldn't have done what the modern proponents of the subject think it should do. Now I'll just have to offer that as my answer to your question, and I guess that's a way of saying I'm not the right person to ask that question.
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think that's an answer in and of itself. So focusing more on the historical angle, your book does have a section on the United States. So could you tell us a little bit about what was natural law like from an American context?
Well, I don't think it was that much different than it was in Europe, in England, and in the European courts. Of course, the legal systems were not exactly the same, and the interests of the new Americans in their new state were not the same as you had on the continent in England. But if you remember that natural law wasn't supposed to provide clear rules in every case, but to be a guide for legislation, a guide for deciding cases, there were connections between what happened in Europe. There were natural connections between the old world and the new. A lot of the problems were not that much different, though the circumstances of the American Republic, that is, the governance of the American Republic, was quite different than you had in many of the European countries. I'm not sure, though, that I'm answering your question. You want to push me in a direction that...
Yeah, well, how about this? So, yeah, so, you know, so obviously, you know, the United States and England share a common law tradition.
Right.
Which is somewhat distinct from the civil law tradition. And especially if we trace natural law back through Roman law and canon law, one might almost expect there to be more of it in Europe, or at least to be very different in Europe, since that legal tradition has hewn somewhat more closely to its Roman and canon predecessors. So is that the case? Is there a big difference between how, you know, the Anglo-Americans used natural law and how the continental Europeans did?
I didn't find that much of a difference in the sources that I used. But you're certainly right to say that the English and the American common law system was not identical with the European system. And if you and still they don't start with the case law. The our law, our legal training today does start with cases, and the traditional system in the continent anyway does not. It starts with the sources of law, and that leads led the legal education to give natural law a place, because there was in the Roman law and in the canon law for sure. And it's not in the case law for sure. Although I've wondered, and this was a question I have for Banner's book. He says that the proliferation of case law showed that the American lawyers didn't need natural law. But the fact is that the case law showed that natural law was important, or was used anyway. I think it's too facile an explanation to say that the proliferation of case law itself caused the end of relevance for natural law, since so much of the case law did mention, at least, the existence and the use of natural law. But if you're just asking about the difference between the common law system and the civil law system, I think there is a clear difference on that score between the continent and the America and the and English systems.
And so, could you? Do you mean generally or in terms of natural law specifically?
Well, both, really.
Yeah. So, could you give us an idea of what some of those differences were?
Well, one difference is that if you start with the natural law, which is on the first page of the digest, that is the Roman law, and it's on the first page of the canon law, it makes it easier to for the teacher and for the students to relate what they find when they get into the body of the law, the substantive law, to relate back to its relationship to the common law. But if you start with the cases, particularly cases that don't mention natural law, and natural law begins to seem something like of an intruder, which is what it is now in American law school, it loses its centrality if you don't start with it.
And so there also seems to me to be a difference, not just, you know, geographically and in terms of these traditions, but also temporally. I mean, your book, one of the things it does is it covers a huge, wide swath of time, and legal traditions are changing throughout those. So, you know, does the medieval period, obviously, the jus gentium, the canon law, has a particular relationship with the common law of Europe, meaning the law of the states, that's different than, say, the 17th and 18th centuries, where you begin to see formulations of, you know, more legal, I guess maybe integral, meaning integrated legal systems in different polities. And then particularly when you come to the 19th century and you see the codification movements in Germany. So could you give us a sense of how does natural law on the continent change over time? Obviously, one would expect that natural law would have a different role in the 12th century versus the 15th century versus the 18th or 19th centuries.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, but the answer I have to give is I don't know. My book is about the history of the subject, and I hesitate to say anything about the modern situation on the continent just out of ignorance. I think the same thing has happened on the continent, roughly. But I just don't know enough about the actual history of the subject to be able to speak to that point. I wish I did, but I guess I just have to plead again that I'm just a legal historian and not an expert on the subject.
Right, but for the history, if we could just go, if we push it back further, say medieval to more modern times, did natural law serve the same role in, say, like a feudalistic state that it served in a more mercantile state, say, like the Spanish Empire or early modern England?
I think so. And you have to remember the modest role that natural law served. It was a background, a starting point, a guide. It wasn't, you could have completely different economic systems and still have them all make some use of the natural law. I think that's clear enough. The mercantilist system seems quite different from the system that you have in the Middle Ages or now, that we have now. But that only emphasizes the modest role, the supplementary role, the advisory role of a natural law in the functioning system of any legal regime. And that was one of the, I suppose it'd be one of the disappointing things for a modern natural law lawyer, a proponent of natural law, to find out how limited the use of natural law, or how natural law could be used and accepted by quite different legal regimes.
So your book, and this is going to put you on the spot again, so I hope I'm not exceeding my limit too far. So your book is restricted to Europe. Do you have any sense of natural law in other traditions that exist? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, only a little bit, and that's secondhand. There's a volume called Christianity and Natural Law, edited by Norman Doe, which appeared from the Cambridge University Press a few years ago. And it looks at the natural law from a philosophical perspective and from the perspective of different faith traditions in the West. I think that the same thing could be done with natural law in the Islamic tradition. At least that I took part in a symposium on the subject, and I think there was some suggestion of that, but I'm not sure that it's been done yet. That may just be my ignorance of the correct answer to your question, but I think that would be a very interesting starting to make a very interesting book and a very interesting conference to talk about different faith traditions and what they had to contribute to the study of the history of natural law, and even what they say about things today. I can't answer your question again because I don't know very much about the Islamic tradition or the Buddhist Confucianism, but it'd be interesting to compare the history of natural law and the history of those traditions.
Well, that's great. So I just have a couple of more questions coming from your book. Another thing that sprung to mind while reading is, you know, and this also is thread through people who talk about natural law today. What is the relationship between natural law and justice? Are they synonymous terms historically in the European tradition, or is there a distinction between the two?
I'm not sure I can answer that question without a specific example. I think that the you could say that the natural law was a guide to justice. Let's take a concrete example that I talk about in the book. That's the right of self-defense. If someone attacks you, do you have a right to fight back? And the natural law said, yes, you do. You can observe that in nature every day. Animals behave that way. And there's a natural inclination not to submit to someone who attacks you. And that's a kind of a guide to justice. It doesn't give you many details, but it shows that you have the right to a self-defense as you do in modern law. And that right founded in natural law can take different forms, but any form it takes ought to acknowledge and take account of the starting point, which is the right that you find in natural law to defend yourself, and that makes a difference. Of course, it can be taken away, in partially at least, if the state provides a way for you to defend yourself in its legal system. But the goal must be the same of providing you an adequate way to defend yourself and your property and your family. So it can take many forms, but it ought to take some form. That's what natural law would tell you.
Right. And maybe another question I had that goes maybe along with the term justice is in the book, and I think also in reading legal decisions that discuss natural law, there's also, maybe a justification that's used, is maybe the best way of terming it, for knowing whether something violates natural law is that it's against reason. That's just something violates, reason, common sense, principles of, natural. I'm using the term natural and to describe natural law, but, something is against what seems to be the common framework of reality. So one of the questions I had in reading your book is, what's the relationship between reason and natural law, or nature and natural law? Why do we often run across this phrase being something being against reason?
I think because it's the common response to a problem is to a legal problem, or to really any problem, is to think about it. What are the consequences of adopting one rule or another? Where you have a choice between those two, you want to think through what the consequences are. And that's one thing that natural law helps you to do. Just to take the same example of self-defense, if you think through by reason what the consequences of taking a particular view are, you will act in accordance with natural law. For example, do you have a right to use an atomic weapon against a man who trespasses on your property? Well, you have a right to defend yourself, but I don't think you have a right to use a guided missile to stop him, which is powered by which is a sort of an atomic nuclear missile. In other words, reason is a way of thinking through what the consequences of taking any particular legal position will be, and that's what natural law helps you to do. Because it's based upon the innate reason, at least it claims to be based upon the innate reason that all thinking creatures have to deal with the problems that they face. And natural law is a guide in helping you to do that, though the answer that it gives is not always absolutely black and white.
So that's interesting, that last point. It's not absolutely black and white. Can you give us an example where maybe sometimes natural law reasoning might have kind of wound up, put us in a gray area?
Well, the example I can think of in the that is one I've already mentioned. Does someone accused of a crime, does he need a lawyer? Well, it was not clear to our ancestors that they did. Lawyers confuse things. They get in the way of the truth. They raise procedural objections. They may actually harm the search for the truth. Or they may stand against the search for the truth. That's what they thought. And that's not completely crazy. It should be balanced against what lawyers can do and what the consequences of not having a lawyer to defend you are. We've made our judgment today about that point, and natural law helps you to think about that because it concentrates your attention on what the purpose of being defended, the purpose of being able to defend yourself against a charge are. It doesn't give you an answer, it just gives you a start. And that's why I think that's the way you use natural law then. And reason, I think, comes into our law today in somewhat the same way. We just don't call it natural law.
Well, that's a great answer. And so we are coming about to the end of the hour. So the last question we traditionally ask here at the New Books Network is, are you working on any new projects and what might they be?
Well, I have a bunch of small projects to work on, but I'm 80 years old and I'm probably not going to write another book. So the answer is that I'm cultivating my garden, and I'm grateful to you and anyone who's interested in what I've done so far, and always willing to and anxious to talk about them, talk about those subjects. And so I'll just end by thanking you very much for taking an interest in the book, and for inviting me to take part in this interview, which I've enjoyed.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, Professor Helmholtz. We are certainly grateful for you being here. And we also thank you, the listeners, for listening today. This is the New Books in the Law, a channel on the New Books Network.